supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Democrats and Republicans will vie for control of Congress in the midterm elections later this year, and a number of seats in this region will be key battlegrounds. WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies has been looking through campaign finance reports for clues as to how the two parties are faring, and he joins me now in the studio. Dave, what do these campaign finance reports reveal, and what are you looking for?
Well, Dave, the reports tell us where the candidates are getting their money and what they're doing with it. Federal candidates only have to file four times a year, and we just got the reports for July. And I wanted to look at the Republican candidates in districts in the Philadelphia suburbs that were all redrawn this spring to be much more Democratic-friendly. Fundraising is only one measure of a campaign, but I wanted to see whether these Republican candidates are raising the kind of money they need to run a serious campaign.
And with that, what did you find?
Well, in the districts in Montgomery County and Delaware County, the Republican candidates actually have more on hand right now than the Democratic candidates. Dan David, who's a skip-back businessman in Montgomery County, has about $200,000. He's the Republican. That's more than the Democrat, Madeline Dean, who is favored. In Delaware County, Pearl Kim, she's a former prosecutor, has nearly $300,000 in the bank. That's more than the Democratic hopeful, Mary Gay Scanlon. Now, you have to remember that the Democrats just fought primary campaigns, so they're a little depleted. But the other thing that's striking is that in these Republican campaigns, in every case, more than half the money comes in contributions from the candidates themselves in the amount of hundreds of thousands of dollars. So what we see are successful people running candidacies, and they've made a personal commitment to them, but so far not the kind of outside fundraising horsepower they're going to need. I'll just add that in Chester County, Democrat Chrissy Houlihan has a huge lead, $2 million over her opponent, a tax attorney named Greg McCauley, who's just underway.
Dave, let's cross to Delaware. There are a couple of closely watched congressional races in the Garden State. What did you find there?
Well, we have Tom MacArthur, of course, Dave, the two-term Republican incumbent who has been supportive of President Trump but kind of walking a fine line. This is a swing district. He is challenged by a Democrat, Andy Kim, who has actually more money on hand right now than MacArthur. Kim has $1.7 million. That's a pretty good take to MacArthur's $1 million. The other race is to replace the retiring Republican Frank Lobiondo in South Jersey. And the Democrat there, Jeff Van Drew, has a big edge, both because he has a lot more money and because the Republican candidate, Seth Grossman, has made some pretty controversial, racially tinged statements. In fact, a lot of national Republican leaders would like him to step aside.
In our time remaining, we need to touch on the battle in Bucks County, where Republican Congressman Brian Fitzpatrick is challenged by the independently wealthy Democrat, Scott Wallace.
Yeah, that's a knockdown, drag-out fight. Already is. Wallace has put nearly $5 million of his own money into the race, and that's not all. People may have heard this ad running lately on televisions in this market.
Brian Fitzpatrick voted for the Republican tax plan that raises taxes on middle-class families. Look it up for yourself. It raises taxes on 36 million middle-class families.
Now, that's not from the Democratic candidate, Scott Wallace. That's from a liberal group, an independent group called Not One Penny. It's attacking Fitzpatrick for his vote for the Trump tax plan. Obviously, he has a different case to make for his vote. But you can expect lots of outside groups to weigh in on that race and others if they look closer than they are now.
Dave, you said at the onset that fundraising is one measure of the strength of a campaign. Everything else being equal, is it the primary variable?
No, I think as things get going, you look and see how active they are campaigning. You see what kind of endorsements you pick up. You see what polls tell you. And I think especially you look at what national party leaders are doing. If the Republican Party thinks that they have a real shot in these suburbs, you'll see the national parties weigh in a big way.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you.
WHYY senior reporter Dave Davies on NewsWorks Tonight. Wilmington, Delaware Mayor Mike Perzicki has issued an apology and is meeting with members of the Muslim community. This after a teacher and her elementary school-aged students of the Islamic faith were asked to leave a public pool. WHYY's Zoe Reed reports.
Members of a summer Arabic enrichment program say they were asked to leave a city pool last month because they were wearing cotton clothing and headscarves, despite being frequent visitors to the pool, and no visible signage about the garments being inappropriate. They say the pool manager even called the police on them. Navid Bakir of the Delaware Council on Global and Muslim Affairs says he believes the pool manager used the so-called no-cotton policy as an excuse to discriminate against the group. He says incidents like these aren't uncommon.
A lot of times situations do not escalate to this level. People just walk away when they're faced with this type of comment, but it happened quite frequently. Personally, I have been asked to leave a pool long ago, you know, several years ago, because my family is affluent enough. We made a point that we are not going to use public facilities. We will just go to a private facility and we'll pay the private facility who do listen to our requests.
Over the weekend, Przycki issued an apology, saying the city used poor judgment. Przycki says going forward, there should be clear policies in place.
The sensible thing to do now is for us to enforce a very loosely worded policy of appropriate dress and be as permissive as we can about it and alter from that course only if we think there's a safety issue, and then put together sensible policies over the next year and promulgate them early so everybody knows what the rules are and nobody feels they're being discriminated against.
The mayor says he's arranging meetings with the Muslim community and the group asked to leave the pool to strengthen mutual understanding. From the Delaware Desk, Zoe Reed, WHYY News.
Pennsylvania's online system for birth and death records was shut down by authorities for about a week last month after unauthorized changes were detected. AP reporter Mark Scalforo investigated the revelation and joins me now with details. Mark, thanks for joining us on NewsWorks Tonight.
Hello.
That this took place last month, when did the problem come to light?
I was able to confirm Thursday that some sort of incident had happened, and then on Friday they made it clear that the site had been affected, that this the website for birth and death records had been the subject of cosmetic modifications, and that's what prompted their extensive investigation to see if there was a data breach. The state has concluded there was not.
What does cosmetic mean in this regard?
Well, it's not clear exactly what it means, but I think it may have been changes to the homepage.
And is there a sense of who the perpetrator or perpetrators might be?
Well, interestingly, they said that there was, and I want to get the phrasing properly, but that it was somebody with apparent inside knowledge. They've called in the police, so that does sound like they may have a person or a universe of people in mind, but they have not said anything more than that.
So reassuring on the face of it that no breach of data occurred, but what kind of data is on there? I'm surmising perhaps Social Security numbers, birth certificate information?
Yeah, birth and death records. If you want to request a birth certificate online rather than going into one of the few offices across the state where you can do that in person, this is how you do that.
Which leads us to the second aspect of this story, that being there's been a chronic hue and cry over the delay in obtaining records from those who desire to do so.
That's right. Oddly, maybe it's a coincidence, maybe not, but they had to take the computer system for vital records offline from June 20th when they discovered it until June 26th, and that was right around the time of the state budget, and in that state budget, lawmakers and the governor earmarked $2.3 million to hire several dozen more people to chip away at the backlog. Apparently, in some cases, people can go months and months after requesting these records online before they get a response. And if you mail in a request, my understanding is that's the longest delay of all. We're talking many months in some cases. So for people who need these records quickly, this has been a subject of some consternation. A number of lawmakers say that they've gotten complaints about it from constituents. And so there were hearings earlier this year as part of the budget process in which the health department that runs the site, they were asked about this and what to do about it. And they brought in a consultant. And my understanding is the consultant, which apparently usually does not recommend hire more people to solve the problems they try to help solve, in this case, thought that it would be a good idea. So right around the time that this website was the subject of some sort of attack, the state was also devoting more money to solve the problem of these backlogs.
The delays you cite seem rather onerous, though are other states much quicker about turning those records over?
From what I've gathered, people who look at these issues in different states, and I'm thinking here of a genealogy website that made note of Pennsylvania's long delay as being outside the norm, yes.
Speak to the details around Chester Republican State Representative John Lawrence's proposal.
Oh, well, he has, and in fact, the House overwhelmingly passed his bill that would, as he said, it would create a study, because that's normally what happens with these kinds of problems. But also, the fee for these records, none of it goes to help run the system. So his bill would devote a portion of the fee to help run the system, with the idea that, he said, most people think that if you pay a fee to a government agency, that helps operate the agency you're dealing with. So that's not the case now, but it would be under his bill. And also, it would greatly expand who may issue birth certificates in Pennsylvania. And that proposal is currently pending in the state Senate.
Back to what is not being described as a breach of data. Is this an example of other vulnerabilities to hacking in the past?
I mean, I think any time someone can get into your computer system and make changes that the whole world sees when they go to access your system, and it's a public, you know, a public body, a governmental system, that's probably as big a problem as computer security has in the state. Whether it suggests greater vulnerability or not, just the fact that they were able to do that is a certain amount of troubling vulnerability.
Has the Wolf administration weighed in on whether the governor is likely to sign a piece of legislation that comes before him?
Good question. I haven't asked them that, but I can say that it passed the House maybe with two no votes, overwhelmingly. That usually, those kinds of measures, if they can get out of both chambers with overwhelming support, that's usually a pretty good sign the governor's going to be on board. But I have to stress, they haven't told me that.
Mark, one personal question. Were you born in Pennsylvania?
No, I was born in Virginia.
Well, lucky you. I am from the Keystone State, so keep your fingers crossed for me.
If you were born before 1967, I can tell you that trying to get an old birth certificate from that period is much more difficult in terms of the delays than the one since then. I won't ask your age, but that's a major dividing point in terms of their ability to access them quickly and get them out to people, 1967.
And why is that the threshold year?
It's my understanding that before that, they did not always name the parents. There's a short-form birth certificate. And by the way, under Real ID, which is the federal, the new federal driver's license requirements that have been sort of very slowly being enacted, that are going to take force 2019. Under that law, you do need to be able to prove your identity with the longer form birth certificate that has both parents listed. And this is why they think that this computer system that was just down for 7 days is going to probably get a great deal more use and attention in the years to come.
Thank you so much for bringing us up to speed.
Hey, have a wonderful day.
AP reporter Mark Scalforo joining us on Newsworks Tonight. What do you get when you combine an ice cream entrepreneur trained in Delaware with a classic New Jersey breakfast meat? Answer, a viral hit that's getting attention from around the world as WHYY's Mark Eichmann offers up a taste of pork roll ice cream.
Along the rolling hills in Sussex County in the northwest corner of New Jersey sits Windy Brow Farms. This is where University of Delaware graduate Jake Hunt is creating an unusual, some would say odd, maybe bizarre, ice cream flavor. Hunt stays very busy these days thanks to his curious concoction that stirs pieces of the breakfast meat, pork roll, and French toast into ice cream. For the unfamiliar, pork roll is best described as a cross between ham and Canadian bacon. It's even celebrated with its own festival in Trenton.
Pork roll is bacon's naughty little cousin.
Pork roll is also sometimes called by the brand name Taylor Ham. Debate over its rightful name can get heated, with South Jerseyans calling it pork roll, people in North Jersey, Taylor Ham. And while it's enjoyed at breakfast and other mealtimes, it's never been considered a dessert.
It starts with taking Taylor ham that we chop up into slices, and then that gets tossed with cinnamon and sugar. We take that out of the oven, mix it with our homemade French toast, mix that with more maple syrup, bring it all together, make a maple ice cream base, and then it just gets swirled in and freezes for 12 hours. It's been an interesting ride so far. I didn't think that something so crazy as this was going to take as wild of a turn as it has. I think we've been surprised by the amount of people that have come out and tried it.
After its debut, the creation grabbed headlines around the world. Culinary website Eater called it the ultimate New Jersey delicacy, while others like Vice.com were less impressed, calling pork roll ice cream an abomination. But these days, creativity is king for ice cream shops, exploring new flavors and pushing the limits of customers' palates.
There's a lot of people that are doing some really interesting, creative, strange things with ice cream out there. And I think as tastes change and perception changes, people are going to be more open to that kind of thing.
The ice cream is part of Hunt's Only in Jersey collection of flavors he's debuting this summer to celebrate his creamery's fifth anniversary. Earlier this summer, he took his sweet, savory flavor to Trenton's Pork Roll Festival to give fans a taste.
It's different. It tastes really good, and it can be deceiving because it's pork roll and ice cream mixed together, but I'm going to tell you, it tastes really good.
It's a little bit sweet and a little salty. It's a perfect combination.
It's fantastic. I love it. I love it. There's nothing that pork roll doesn't improve.
We know we have a good product, but definitely surprised by the amount of people that like it and have learned to love it, even though they went into it thinking it was going to be disgusting.
Although it does have an unusual texture, it's definitely not disgusting. While Jake's family has been farming in northern New Jersey for nearly 350 years, he got his start in the ice cream biz while a student at the University of Delaware.
I was part of an internship team with the U Dairy Creamery. That existed before we even had a building and before we even had a creamery.
Melinda Shaw, manager at UD's on-campus creamery, is proud of Hunt's success and even has a friendly rivalry.
He definitely has some unique flavors. We try not to outshoot each other on the flavor side, but I think he got us with the pork roll. We're pretty excited that it's so successful for him.
$10.
The U Dairy Creamery has been quite successful, too. I recommend the goat cheese and fig flavor. UD recently celebrated its one-year anniversary at its location in downtown Wilmington and plans to expand into cheese production in the near future.
It's a great time to be in the ice cream business because there is so much creativity allowed.
Back in North Jersey, Jake Hunt has plans for more flavors in the Only in Jersey series.
We're going to do a roasted tomato flavor at some point this summer, which I think will really kind of get people intrigued, but isn't all that outlandish. And we're going to do a sweet corn flavor that really highlights the production of sweet corn that we have here in New Jersey. But we don't think they're going to go as crazy as this one has. This one will keep us crazy enough for long enough.
From the Delaware desk, Mark Eichmann, WHYY News.
Let's return to those thrilling days of yesteryear when mankind first walked on the moon. Joining me with a look back and then ahead is Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. Derek, this time around, there's a new way to take in what took place in the summer of 69.
It's a really exciting way for people who did not experience the first man landing on the moon to get a feel for all of the excitement that surrounded this truly historic human exploration event. There is a website, firstmenonthemoon.com, that allows a viewer to actually listen to a replay of the actual audio communications between ground control and the astronauts from about 15 minutes before Apollo 11 landed on the surface of the moon. There's a center screen that shows you whatever video might have been taking place or available at that time. And then flanking that center screen on the left, you see the text of the communication of Neil Armstrong and Buzz Aldrin on board Apollo 11 as it's heading down toward the surface to land. On the right side of that center screen, you see the text of all of the communications that's happening back at ground control. And all of this is taking place in this tightly packed period of about 15 minutes.
Spoiler alert, they land successfully, but I imagine it's just as thrilling to watch this replay as it was those 49 years ago.
I think it's even more exciting in that there's so much going on behind the scenes that we weren't aware of at the time. And if any of those things go wrong, what they'll do is they'll communicate that back up to the Apollo astronauts and tell them to abort the mission. They're not involved in that at all. They're focused on landing the spacecraft safely. And as we all know, in the last minute or so, Neil Armstrong had to take command of the over the automatic landing system in order to avoid a boulder field where the spacecraft was originally targeted to land. But as you see this unfolding, It's all happening in real time in the last like 2 or 3 minutes before the spacecraft is supposed to land, while all this other monitoring of systems and health and all that stuff is going on.
Is it an overstatement to say that the technology was positively primitive compared to what we have now?
Think of any measure you'd like to think of. Your smartphone is 10 times, 100 times, 1,000 times more capable in terms of computer capability than what they had at the time. The communications we have these days is so much better. Propulsion systems are so much better. In fact, if you went back and you looked at the cockpit of the lunar module, you would wonder how they ever flew such an antiquated piece of equipment all the way to the moon and back. Well, I think the big secret is that you had two irreplaceable pieces of equipment, and those were the humans on board.
Let's also give props to the third man overhead for the duration.
Yes, Michael Collins, who was in the command module orbiting the moon. He was in control of the ship that would bring everybody back to Earth. It put him farther away from the Earth than any other human at any point in human history. So he had a very unique perspective, and it was one that he actually relished. He's actually said he enjoyed his time alone in the spacecraft.
Hanging out on the dark side.
On the dark side, looking back at a spectacular planet Earth.
With clear skies, which planets are available to be seen this week?
It's as if there's a samba line of planets moving across the sky from west all the way back over to east. So just as the sky is getting dark at 9:15 in the evening, over on the western side, brilliant Venus. If we come back to the left around to the south, we find gleaming Jupiter. A little bit further to the east, a little dimmer but still out there and not twinkling like the other planets, is Saturn. And then by 11 p.m. over on the eastern side of the sky, now up high enough in the east, is Mars. If you're having difficulty tracing these planets down, an easy way to do it is simply look for where the moon will be found. So the moon will be right above Jupiter on July 20th. It'll be right above Saturn on July 24th and right above Mars on July 27th. So that makes it really easy.
Thanks, Derek.
My pleasure, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on Newsworks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller. Newsworks Tonight.